Good evening. Welcome to The Pipeline. This is the Western Standard's weekly panel show where we'll pick a few top issues and dissect them and discuss them, go through them and see what they mean and offer at least our two bits on what we think they're about. So myself, I'm Corey Morgan, one of the columnists at the Western Standard, and I'm joined by two other folks today. Starting on my immediate right, we've got our opinion editor, Nigel Hannaford, as usual.
Hello again, Corey.
Hello. Good to have you here. We got such a rotating crowd going on. I never know who's going to be next to me week by week lately, but you're a good solid standby.
I've staked out of this chair. It's mine.
I appreciate it. And on the end, an occasional contributor, though you were on my other show earlier today, Sean Polzer from the news department. Welcome to the pipeline this evening, Sean.
Hello again.
Yes, it's long time no see. So, and we don't have to cover too many names. I'm sorry, during my show earlier, I have to point out, the reason I started laughing at one point, there was one story you went through, but I do it too, so I'm not getting on a high horse, but you slaughtered the pronunciation of all three political names that of the people you had in that story. I was trying to think, should I interject? No, I was probably going to throw them off even more, but we're going to boogie about it now.
Well, that's usually in fun. We usually do it deliberately.
Oh, yeah. So I'll probably mess up somebody's name by the end of this show, too, just to show how I'm just as well capable. It's worse when I get the live guests and I screw it up and they're looking at me.
Yeah.
Whatever. All part of the fun. Okay, well, let's get into the more important issues going on federally. Boy, the prime minister, as you said, what's going on with all of these prime ministerial budget announcements? It feels like a campaign right now.
Well, you know, first of all, they are budget announcements. And this is a gross deviation from parliamentary practice that you even say what's going to be in the budget before you drop the budget. I mean, there's a reason for it. It gives people a chance to, people with money, to make dispositions in advance that they shouldn't have any advance notice of. But I guess it shows you, quite apart from anything that we might talk about as to where the Prime Minister is going with all of this and whether there could be, heavens above, an early election. Unlikely, but it's consistent. But it shows you what he thinks of tradition in the parliamentary system. You know, he just doesn't care.
Well, yeah, I mean, traditionally, it would have been more like you hear maybe a few whispers, but I mean, you're stuck, you're embargoed if you're in the House of Commons. Well, that's the advance notice you'll get until that thing is tabled.
If you had a whisper in days gone by, the finance minister would resign.
Yeah.
You know, it was that serious. Even if it wasn't him who breached confidence, if something got out, he would take responsibility and resign. Now they just go out there and tell everybody what's going to be in the budget.
Well, it's a valid point. It's kind of like insider trading on the stock market. Like Sean, I pointed out, you've got $2.4 billion that hasn't been that well designated. It's going to develop AI in Canada, maybe a worthy cause, but boy, that's a big pool of money. We're not exactly sure where it's going. And now they've got an advance notice, or at least perhaps some unprincipled people realizing I better set up businesses that purport to provide AI services or development so I can get a piece of this while it's all coming out and even before the budget's been announced. That's kind of an inside thing to get in advance there too, isn't it?
I'm not so sure. You know, he was in town on Friday and it just kind of struck me as kind of a little bit of a nothing muffin. You know, they were at a modular home factory and they've been telegraphing all these things about, you know, housing and stuff, and they're talking about AI to build houses and that kind of thing. And it just kind of seemed to me that it was a lot more hype than maybe it was worth.
But it's the amount, you know, $2.4 billion. I mean, that's a lot of change, even on a federal budget as a line item.
Well, even on the housing, it was, I'm not sure how many billion that was. That's about $2.5 billion, all told, $600 million on Friday alone. You know, so, but they're running around throwing these numbers around, and it's like nobody cares. They've thrown around so much money already. It's like, you know, how much more can you throw at the problem, you know?
I mean, nobody cares, but I mean, how many people actually believe?
Well, that's another good point, too, because they've promised a lot of things in the past and like years ago, and then they just kind of
never quite happens.
Yeah, but I mean, forget about them.
And the numbers are big and should be concerning, but we're becoming cynical or indifferent. I mean, how many people believe? But the other thing is, it's hard to wrap your head around numbers when it gets into the billions. I mean, that's been discussed on shows before and things. You know, the reason a $16 orange juice could take down a minister in the past, even though we overlook badly appropriated billions of dollars, is because your average citizen doesn't think in billions. We do understand going to a restaurant and you would be appalled by a $16 glass of orange juice, but it just doesn't run in your head in the billions. It just doesn't quite click.
On the other hand, you don't go to the kind of restaurants, and I don't go to the kind of restaurants where they would charge $16. And by the way, that happened a long time ago, back in the Harper era. So probably that $16 orange juice is more like $25 now. But if you're traveling on government business, you have to stay in those places. They don't let you pull into the motel.
Well, that happened to me when I was in Spain at the Herald. I had to bill for $18 orange juice in Madrid. And it was like, I really, you know, and then it was like, I had a little bit of sympathy for these people because I couldn't really get around it either.
Yeah.
Did
I actually pay it?
They actually did. You know, the beer was only $7. The orange juice was like $18.
Thinking of a Helsinki airport many, many years ago, and myself and another fellow, we were layover for one in Moscow, and it was $32 for two soups and a beer because they dinged us on the travel. That's how long ago it was. Traveler's checks, cashing, and then the conversion,
right,
and then the airport prices. And if I had expensed that somewhere at that time in, you know, 87, people would have lost their But as I said, I was just talking about the dollars. That's how, you know, people can relate, though, on how outrageous that amount is. They don't think about how outrageous, well, 100 million here, a billion there. That doesn't resonate.
You know, when you were talking about the election, though, that was kind of an interesting point as well, because I was thinking to myself, you know, I've only seen Trudeau in Calgary like, well, three times since 2015, once in 2016, and then twice here in about the last 6 weeks. And I was kind of, you know, he really hasn't, you know, now he's coming into Alberta, it seems like almost every few weeks. And it did kind of feel like a campaign announcement.
No sense. I mean, just looking at the Liberal numbers right now, they'd be insane to pull the trigger on an election. But the feel of it, as I said, Trudeau was hiding out from the House of Commons the other day. That's nothing new.
So what he's trying to do, he's trying to grab this issue back from Pierre Poilievre.
Yeah.
Because there's no question about it that the very high standings of Pierre Poilievre are in the polls right now, largely because he's speaking to a whole generation of people who are going to have a lot of difficulty in establishing themselves in the housing market.
Oh, if so, they can at all.
If they can. I think you still can in Calgary, actually. But anyway, be that as it may, how do you go back? Well, you go out and you make all of these grand announcements about how you're going to put money out there for housing, you're going to make loans available, you're going to interfere with the CMHC.
The municipalities.
And the municipalities. And it's people forget this. In all the excitement and the buzz and the bright lights, they forget that this is a problem of this government's own making. By ginning up the interest rates, which they have done through excessive borrowing, and then by creating an artificial demand by increased immigration, there is now a shortage of supply compared to the demand. Up goes the price. This is how it happened, and now this is government policy. And it is perhaps a niche point of view, but my point of view on it, folks, is that they're doing this to disguise the fact that GDP growth in Canada would actually be negative if it wasn't for the rising property market.
And the immigration that kind of artificially juices that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the other big one that some economists have spoken of is the GDP per capita. It's on a terrible downward trend.
Because of all the people.
That's an important number that people don't pay attention to. But, yeah, they realize, you know, okay, yeah, the pie is getting bigger, but our pieces are getting smaller.
That's exactly right. You've got it. You know, there's one other thing that needs to be said in this discussion, and it is that housing shouldn't even be something that Ottawa does. Constitutionally speaking, Ottawa does not do that as a provincial function. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, it should be just a simple matter of builders come along, get approvals, build houses according to the demand. Government shouldn't even be involved. But that the way things have trended, that is what has happened. But, you know, this has got a long history. Back in the last century, the federal government sold the provincial governments on health care. They would give 50 cents on the dollar. What happened? Then in the 90s, the federal governments fell into huge debt, and they welched on the deal. They said, "Look, we're not doing this anymore. You get 15 cents from the Canada Health and Social Transfer. Make the most of it, boys." And the provinces could not afford electorally to let health sink. So all the money that in the past they had been able to devote to things like housing suddenly got pulled into health. And as a result, if you think that government financing has a place in the housing market, well, the provinces don't have any money to put there. But now the federal government comes along and they can borrow, they can print. There's money here, there's money there, and it's all an attempt to make Canadians look inwards towards the center, to see the federal government as the source for everything, from your pension to your, well, to your housing, elevating themselves at the expense of the provinces. No wonder Daniel Smith is up in arms.
Well, they're setting themselves up to fail as well, because they've already got a built-in excuse to back out of it, and that is some of these green policy initiatives that they want to extend into home building and municipalities. So that's increased density, that's this blanket rezoning that people are up in arms against here in Calgary, so-called retrofitting of these construction module mm-hmm. things to make them energy efficient and meet their emissions caps and all that kind of thing. And a lot of that money is conditional on that. And Trudeau basically said, if the Alberta government doesn't want to, do these things that we want them to, then don't take our money.
Yeah, well, we'll get on to that, the interjurisdictional mess that's being created out of all of this, and then a lot of the intergovernmental ire. Maybe we'll start things before we break on it with a light note. Our finance minister heading out to Ottawa, it looks like we're on a plane there, to deliver the budget, and she got to meet a social media celebrity, Kat Canada, though perhaps Chrystia Freeland didn't realize who she was chatting with. So here's a little video clip of Kat Canada and Chrystia Freeland enjoying some quality time together on one of our flights in Canada there.
Air Canada executive class.
Look who I ran into. Can you wave to my followers on Twitter?
Sure. Hi.
Either way, that aside, so getting on to this, money. Boy, this government, it's going to be interesting to see this budget. How big it's going to be by the time the actual budget comes out. So it's certainly gotten Premier Smith, got her back up. You've got this, I guess, foreign leader, as far as I'd call it, but I'm quite an independence-minded person, but keeps coming in and making these announcements and then taking off and leaving the province to hold the bag and really deal with the administration and all of that. And it sounds like they're considering legislation just to stop the federal government from going directly to municipalities.
Well, it's something some people call it an oversight, but municipalities aren't recognized as a distinct level of government in the Constitution. So maybe for some of these cities like Toronto and Vancouver, arguably they're almost kind of like city states, more or less unto themselves. But for regular old cities and towns, like we have here in Alberta, those are the purview of the Alberta government. They're basically just an extension of the Alberta government. The Alberta government can withdraw these people or, take away their spending power. They basically can tell them
what to do. We've seen them take a mayor and some council members out of power. Admittedly in a small municipality, but
right.
Showed the government does have that authority if they ever had
to. Chestermere, Medicine Hat. There's been kind of a few cases or implementing some of these ridiculous, bylaws like the single-use ketchup bylaw, like when municipalities are overstepping their bounds, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that this is just kind of a and it seems deliberate part on the federal government to try to bypass
they kind of leapfrog right over the provincial legislature and land rate in City Hall.
So and show up with money. Yes. Yeah, show up with dollars. And how are you supposed to say no to it? Right?
So what do you think, Nigel, though, with this legislation? It's being framed terribly already, of course, but that's not unusual in legacy media. Quebec already does this. A lot of people not mentioning that Quebec's had this legislation in place for a long time. Of course, they're a province that has never hesitated to say that, no, we'll deal with our affairs. You stay out. And that's all there is to it. I don't see why it's unreasonable for Alberta to do the same.
Well, certainly is not, is it? Every province should lay down the line as to where their influence extends and where the federal government stops. But it was like I was saying, it's not as if this is just accidental. There is a strategy here. It's been going on for a very long time. It predates Mr. Trudeau, but it goes back to his father. But there is this concentrated effort to elevate Ottawa at the expense of the provinces. And any time you come by and say, here's money, but it's conditional, you buy into that. So that's what Smith is saying no to. I don't blame her.
Well, it puts the provinces in a real tough spot, too, because what they love doing is coming in and saying, this is what's going to go into this program.
Right.
If the premier makes a stink, they say, well, you know what? We'll just take the money and go back to Ottawa. And then, you know, the premier looks like this heartless soul who's saying they're throwing away money and opportunities for Albertans.
Well, that's what the NDP will say, absolutely. But, you know, remember Trudeau came in and said, well, take our money. Whose money would that be, sir? You know?
Ours. But, you know, that's another part of all this, because my understanding is that the grants that Quebec does get under these federal programs, they're all kind of mishmashed in on a per capita formula, and the federal government doesn't tell them how to allocate these dollars. They just give them a lump sum based on populations and say, here, you go, you know, split it up whatever way you want it. And at the same time, they're coming out here, you know, into Calgary and making housing announcements saying, well, you have to densify, you have to rezone everything, you know, to allow eight plexes on your, you know.
To be fair, Pierre Poilievre actually proposed something very similar. He's saying that, I could be phrasing it wrong, but he was looking, you know, pointing out that this is provincial jurisdiction and municipal jurisdiction. But if the federal government's going to give housing funds to these cities, we expect the cities to facilitate the growth and outward growth and cuts. Like, he was proposing having strings attached to the municipalities if federal transfers came their way as well.
He did indeed say that. And I do recall that editorially we reacted to that, saying it doesn't make it right just because it's a conservative saying it. Mm-hmm. The federal government has no place in housing.
Yeah, so, and it's just fair to point out that, you know, Justin Trudeau's in good company.
Well, I think that applies more to, say, cities like Toronto and Vancouver. Like, you know, like we're saying, they almost are kind of like entities into themselves. And then they have certain specific needs. And if you're going to donate federal money to Toronto, like, why wouldn't you want to have some kind of condition on it that they're actually going to build houses with it?
But, I mean, it's one right, not the other. I mean, it's recognizing one of the problems we have, too, with getting more housing. Like, with the city of Calgary, I believe it was the data I got from Shane Wenzel, 7 years from concept to development, you know, to get a new development built because of the amount of hurdles and red tape and applications and licensing and all of that garbage you got to go through in this city and the amount of people who have to study this and approve that. And at any time, they could pull the rug out from under you.
Yeah.
You know, Poilievre is recognizing these municipalities have got to step up and get out of the bloody way.
Just used a liberal buzzword. Step up.
Yeah, yes.
Whoa. Yeah,
that's, I've been listening to too much news lately. I'm sorry. It's starting to
overflow.
Our publisher might have a word.
Oh, geez. There comes my starfish award for the year. Corey used a liberal term. Now I feel dirty.
But you know, Corey, doesn't matter how much money you put into it, who are you going to get to build these things?
Yeah. Well, the issue is much bigger than just money.
Well, and on Friday, Trudeau, he used an interesting term to describe it, which he called an industrial project. Like, this house thing is like an industrial policy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they acknowledged like huge worker shortages. I mean, if you're a bricklayer worth your salt, like, you're already busy, you know?
So then we get back into jurisdiction. There's been some talk about the province saying we want more say in then which immigrants are coming in. And we get that catch 22. We've got mass immigration, and it's mass, and they need immigrants when they come here, whether they're temporary or long term. They need a place to stay, they need health care, they need those resources. I'm not faulting them that, but we're letting in more than we're able. Even Trudeau kind of admitted that. But what we need then, we also know that we do need a degree of immigration to keep up with just pretty much everything. It's the nature of our system. We need to start targeting them. We don't need more senior citizens. We don't need more, you know, I hate to be cold and heartless, but we don't need more children coming in. We need working age people who can put in some time and into the working world in some of the areas of need, and maybe if we could stabilize our economy, then you can start talking about bringing in Uncle George and Aunt Martha and your parents and the others. But right now, we're not bringing in productive people.
No, it's back to the 60s.
Well, you know, we did it then. You know, Trudeau, you know, he also kind of admitted, he said at one point, you know, the temporary immigration would be typically about 2% of the population. Right now it's running about 7%. But the irony is that he blamed foreign students and then said, well, education is provincial jurisdiction. You know, well, so it's not my fault.
They play the football with which level of government is at fault.
You know, the diploma mills and all these people, he said, you know, it's the faults of the universities that are bringing in all these people to make up for the lack of funding that they're getting.
The university can't bring anybody in without a federal visa. you know, badminton, back to you. But we've got a big problem. I think we're at that step one, I guess, where the government's acknowledging that there's a problem, but we're a long ways away from a solution.
Well, a year ago, if somebody would have raised it, then Trudeau would have shut them down and called them all racists, bigots and racists, right? So maybe that's progress.
I mean, I guess the ball, though, Nigel, for example, politically, if Premier Smith comes in, brings in this legislation, it comes in fast. Apparently, this could come in next week. I mean, the legislature's in session. The federal response could be, well, we're just not going to transfer.
Yeah. Well, and then you get another court case going and a fight. I mean, they've done this before. Yeah. I recall when Ralph Klein was premier and he wanted to bring in a user fee to just try and control the flow through at emergency departments. People showing up there for frivolous reasons, or maybe not for frivolous reasons, but at the least convenient time. You know, if you struggle with a headache all weekend and then finally go in on Sunday night, that's not fair. Pay your $10. All right. So that was when he brought that in, he was told quite clearly that they would withhold funds from the Canada Health and Social Transfer Tax, and he would be, and they would lose by it. So that could happen. Difference, I think, is that Smith has got much more of a stomach for a fight than Mr. Klein seemed to have. Rolf talked a good game, but when it came down to it, he often backed away from the things that a lot of the base really cared about. This would be a countersuit, and it would have to be expedited. And I think the federal government is contractually obliged to forward this money. It goes out of Alberta. It goes to Ottawa. It's supposed to come back. So
Premier Smith is spoiling for a fight. I mean, that's really marked since she's held the last election, very much a federal-provincial battle.
I'm not sure that she is actually spoiling for a fight. It's the other guys who are spoiling for the fight. But if that's what they want to do, she's ready to do it.
Well, yeah.
And it's not bad politics in Alberta to stand up to the federal government.
Well, and it goes both ways. That's where I think this clash is inevitable. I mean, just looking from a hard political strategy point of view, it's good for Trudeau to fight with Alberta, and it's good for Premier Smith to fight with Ottawa. I mean, so, you know, it's made for them to be adversarial, just hopefully not to the point where the fallout's really actually hurting people when they get into battle.
Well, the animosity is mutual, for sure, because they asked him as well in front of the Calgary Economic Development, about these tensions between Alberta and Ottawa. And then, so he went into this spiel about how he's worked with three U.S. presidents and he's worked with three Alberta premiers, you know, and then it was kind of like the implication was like, by far, you know, I've worked with Donald Trump and I've had to work with Danielle Smith, you know, and Jason Kenney.
I might have added that he got so much work with Donald Trump has got worked over by Donald Trump because he was foolish enough to say something unkind behind as soon as Trump had gone.
Yeah, he was snickering on the sidelines. I mean, again, that was just a whole separate affair. It showed how disrespected he is on the international scene, though. I mean, even people who didn't like President Trump, when they see that kind of behavior going on at a summit, it's not surprising when you see Trudeau on the outside looking in. It's a terribly disrespectful behavior from supposed to be a world leader. Yeah. And he's making fun of the president. And the thing is with Trudeau, but we were still dealing with this guy.
Could be doing it again, too. come November.
Oh, I'm not talking about Trump. I'm talking about Trudeau.
Well, no, yeah, I'm talking about Trudeau.
The whole return of Trump is a whole separate show for us to talk about, which is interesting. I mean, I would have said a year ago, there's no way that Trump's going to be president again. And boy, I would have been very wrong. It's certainly looking like he's going to be there again. So
I was going to offer you odds, but it doesn't seem like you're inclined to take them up.
No, I'm bad with those long-term bets, it seems, so I'm going to stay out of that market. Well, it's taking a little closer to home. I mean, the adversarial and how hyped things up are getting in the legislature, a pretty bizarre interchange between Schmidt and was it Jackie Lovely?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it actually boggles the mind, you know. I mean, adults don't usually behave like that.
No, they really don't.
So there they are. There's a lounge outside the legislature. Lovely has just been speaking about, I think she was making some remarks about how Edmonton should do things. She's an MLA. Everything that goes on in the province is fair game.
Seems to be.
Should be. And out comes an Edmonton MLA. Schmidt.
Yeah, Marlon Schmidt.
Marlon Schmidt. I think, and he starts to berate her. And she said, okay, thanks very much. I've had enough of you. Gets up to leave. And he's blocking her way. Like, this kind of behavior at a nightclub or a restaurant, you know.
It'd probably get you bounced out the door.
Apparently he was mocking her even. Security. Had to
come in and ask him to just step away. And then, of course, we had the very unusual picture of House Leader rising on a point of privilege to complain about the behavior of another MLA. It is a shocking thing. And it sort of goes against what we think we know about legislatures, which is that they'll fight with each other when it's time to fight. Mm-hmm. But there's a certain collegiality between MLAs or members of parliament that allows them to get along quite well in the corridors. Often that is the case. Well, this story seems to suggest that that's not the case.
Well, and even the state of gender relations in this day and age.
This is a man bullying a woman, physically intimidating
you her. You and I are both, 6 feet tall. It's like, you know, if you stand over top of somebody, it's somebody like Michelle over there, who's only like about 5'2". Like, I mean,
this is from the NDP bullying a UCP woman. I mean, it's one of the male feminists that's doing this. I'm going to add my own opinion on that. Those self-styled male feminists quite often just seem to be the ones that actually, when things come around, they're the ones that have the most problems with women. Not always. There's unfortunately abusive men
They don't know how to hold the door.
I mean, if they want to play those games, they should have brought Jason Nixon in to talk with him. This is not going to calm things, but maybe Mr. Schmidt would understand what it is when somebody's standing 2 feet taller than you. Wants to get on your case, but it's just bad form.
Well, bad form, yes. That what has happened to the society we live in when we can generate that kind of. I'm not suggesting that legislatures were always peaceful, friendly places. You'll find, if you go back 200 years, you'll find examples of where they fought duels with each other.
That's
the mace. That's the symbolism of the mace, right? Is to keep people.
But having said that, 200 years ago, men may have fought duels with each other, but they were generally respectful to women. That was part of the deal, the old code of chivalry. I kind of like it.
I think women do too, and secretly.
I people always keep saying this is the worst I've ever seen it. I hear that every legislative and parliamentary session. No, they've always been that way. You can read transcripts from Sir John A. Macdonald and opposition members. I mean, these legislatures are in England even are built for you're facing each other. You're there to fight. That's what it's about. You're going to score points by sometimes personally insulting the other individual. It's not necessarily productive, but it's political theater. It's not new, and we're no worse at it now than I think we ever were in the past. Just maybe we see more of it because we can get those little clips on social media.
You say you're no worse today than we were. Do you actually think that in, you know, even when Sir Winston Churchill was going after Barbara Castle and in some of those kind of really rancid Labour MPs that were getting elected in the 1940s, he would cut them up with his tongue.
So would Thatcher a little later too, yeah.
But he was not the kind to actually follow them down the corridor, find where they were having a cup of tea, and then have them.
No, that's a whole new line has been crossed when you're taking them in their personal space outside of the legislature. I mean, in the legislature with your political theater, whether it's federal or provincial, it's one thing. If you're going to stalk them outside, that's getting...
Well, it's even like reporters when we're out covering these things. I mean, we're all competitors and rivals, but you know, at the same time, you kind of have to... You know, keep the knives down. What is it, like Bugs Bunny? It was the coyote and the dog. And it's like, hey, morning's Ralph. Morning, Sam. Touch the clock. Yeah, go at it. And then.
I remember Daryl Stinson, if you remember, in the federal government, when he was a reform member, rolling up his sleeves, and I can't remember which member it was. Come on, let's go. I'll step outside.
Oh, in Taiwan, they have brawls on the legislature floor.
So it's not unique. I mean, it'd be nice if they tone it down. It builds a bit with the cynicism of voters sometimes if they get too heated and they're spending more time, you know, trying to score shots at each other than actually accomplishing anything. But either way, is there going to be any other sanction for Schmidt, though, other than the speaker saying don't do that again?
Well, you know, hard to say. And I'm not a member of the NDP, so I don't know what goes for, you know, decent behavior in that party. But I would think if that was a member of the UCP that had done something like that, there would be two things. One, there would be a chat with the premier. And secondly, there would be a chat with the constituency association. If that's how you're going to represent us, sir, maybe we will find somebody else.
Yeah, well, it's embarrassing as a constituent. You don't want that.
That would be a very fitting response.
I mean,
I don't expect it, but that's what should happen.
We'll see what turns out with this, too. I mean, if this was a conservative member, at the very well, they'd be demanding a resignation. You know that. But at the very least, they would perhaps be saying this person should be going through some sensitivity training or some of that woke torture and punishment that they do. I got put into a 2-day course of Aboriginal cross-cultural communication over an incident I had up in Onion Lake many years ago. I tell you, that was the worst punishment I ever had. But I was just saying that perhaps Mr. Schmidt might be in line for some of that sensitivity training.
Sensitivity training, yes.
Something. Yeah. Actually, we should move right along because I'm going to be late for my anger management.
I don't want you swinging out and belting me. It's 2 minutes over time, Morgan. I'll try and move it along. Let's go on to more insanity and ludicrous things, I guess. Yeah, he's getting the BC.
Man. You just said the magic.
BC is an insane asylum.
It is.
Let me sketch this out for you.
Sure.
Because I can't believe what I'm reading from there. We have a columnist, Paul Forseth.
Yes,
he's a former member of Parliament. Paul is very diligent. He writes for us once a week. And he sent me this article that was talking about how drug addicts were now permitted to take their drugs into hospital with them, that they were also permitted to keep their weapons with them. Now, I was aware that the government of British Columbia, about a year ago, had received an exemption from Ottawa so that possession of small amounts of illegal drugs would not be a criminal matter. And the idea was that if you destigmatized drug use, well, then it would make it easier for a person to seek help. They wouldn't feel embarrassed to show up at emergency. Okay, so that was the idea. Didn't think it was going to work. Didn't think there was any, that it was a good idea to destigmatize drug use. It should be stigmatized. But that's what they were doing in BC. And then the next thing that came along was that they needed safe supply so that people could depend on the stuff they were putting in their arms and not be worried that it was going to kill them. Because fentanyl, overdoses are very common, and the BC is, I think, the highest per capita in the country. Mm-hmm.
Followed by Alberta.
So this was going, all of that we already knew. But what Paul was describing was testimony from the BC nurses unions that had been shared in the legislature by the opposition health critic, which was saying that nurses were now physically afraid for their safety because these people were drugged up. They had more drugs. They were not allowed to remove or confiscate the drugs, which would, to me, seem like the first thing that you would do. And even more, they were told they couldn't go through the possessions of the person, as a consequence of which some of these people actually have knives and other weapons with them in the hospital bed. The testimony of one of these nurses, and I refer you to Paul's column. Ran it about 10 o'clock this morning. Go look for it. And it talked about how there was one fellow, you know how everybody's in sort of shared rooms these days? They got a bed in each corner.
Yeah.
Well, you imagine yourself being in there. You've just had your appendix out or whatever's been done. And there's a guy in the other corner threshing around naked in the throes of a drug session. And you don't know what he's going to do next. I mean, they have security, but jeepers, man, what can happen between pressing the button for security and somebody actually showing up? It is astonishing. So here's the thing. I called a doctor I know who works in the BC system. It's all true. That's the damnable thing. This is not an exaggeration. This is not a politician taking swipes at the NDP government. This is just what's going on in BC now.
Maybe now that, I hate to say, you know, that a positive coming from a negative, but now that the unions have to step in because nurses and other health practitioners are being put at risk, there's this enablement ideology that I rip into on a regular basis, this ridiculousness, this delusional approach to addicted people, where they try to say they're harmless. They're harmless. They're just addicted. No, that's a load of crap. Go and see the stabbings and the numbers and the things that are happening in home, in the shelters and the train stations and the places where they congregate. Not every addicted person is dangerous, but a lot of them are. And the terms meth-induced psychosis, particularly with meth, fentanyl usually knock them down. Yeah, they're pretty harmless. But the meth, you take that too much too long, you snap, and you can become very, very dangerous.
And they're not themselves. Like, you know, maybe they are nice people. I'm sure everybody is. But when you're in the throes of an addiction like that, you are not.
You're not in your right mind.
You're right. And that's the whole rationale between Premier Smith's policy here about the treatment, right? Is that these people are unable to make these rational choices for themselves. But, you know, it's funny because we were talking about it on your previous show at lunch there about how, you know, these people are smoking crack in the hospital rooms, you know, but if you lit a cigarette, you know,
you'll be arrested. They'll tase you, they'll drag you out of there faster
and fine you.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's exactly $5,000. That is exactly the case.
Yeah.
And the response of the health minister, Adrian Dix, to all of this was, well, we'll set up a task force to look at it.
Now that it's been at least exposed and the union's speaking up, that's where I see perhaps. And the NDP doesn't like listening to citizens and commoners or common sense.
But they listen to
unions. But they listen to unions. And they've been warned. And now that this warning has come out, if they don't get on with their task force or something else, and a nurse gets stabbed or injured or even just an attendant or anybody else working in a hospital.
Or they walk off the job.
And they've ignored that warning. Then we could perhaps see the unions, because the unions tell them what to do. They're going to say, that's enough.
Well,
this is going to change.
You're right, Corey. All of that would happen in a heartbeat if somebody actually gets it. But why should it have to?
What
does a nurse who's there to help people need to get a knife in the gut before the government says, maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all?
Well, that's what I'm saying is hopefully they listen to the warning first.
Yeah.
Because this is your canary in the coal mine, guys.
Uh-huh.
You know, the unions have spoken up. And again, common sense thinking people can see this. But unfortunately, a lot of legislators aren't common sense thinking people.
But, you know, this whole thing has been a complete disaster. They have actually more people dead of drug overdoses this year than last year. And they've had this policy for a year.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, Alberta's numbers are up as well. But there's a very different kind of feel to what Alberta is trying to do here. They're trying to actually salvage people.
Trying treatment here. And, yeah. and over there, they're trying enablement. I think there's some battles in Alberta. Maybe they're getting a little too harsh on the harm mitigation, when there's some aspects of harm mitigation could be useful, but treatment is essential. The enablists on the coast, and I mean, this is a pet subject for me, and I dig into it a lot. They live under this delusion that this is a maintainable condition, that if people could just get enough safe, clean supply, they can carry on with their lives and they'll be all right. It's the bad drugs that are the problem. It's this and that. They never will admit it's an addiction that needs to be treated and somehow eradicated, if possible.
Well, my understanding of it is that they're not devoting the resources to the treatment. There's a shortage of treatment. The people who want to get treated have to wait for months and months and months. And then basically what they're doing is they're just giving them free dope, you know, to kind of tide them over until maybe one day they can,
they
or they will.
Long enough to get to the treatment.
If they survive long enough to get to the treatment.
Which then it gets intercepted by organized crime and resold across the
country. But, you know, that's one thing that Premier Smith is doing in Alberta that I'm very supportive of, because, you know, if you're going to go with a prohibition approach, right, then I think it's incumbent to have the supports available. And like, and she's like drastically increased the number of beds, the number of resources.
If you're going to intervene, you've got to say, okay, but we're putting you here. I mean, we're not just intervening, taking away your drugs and then throwing you out. You've got to say, this is also how now we can hopefully get you back on track, which is a long, expensive, arduous process.
It is, and sometimes it requires intervention. Like during the election campaign, she showed up on stage with parents and
intervention.
Compassionate intervention.
We'll have to do another show on it. I'll hit that. You guys are a bit familiar. I got some issues going on within my own family where we're dealing with some of that, and I've been learning some interesting things and some of the limitations we're sitting at right now, which I'll expand on more at another time.
You know, just before the show, I think you and I were talking about it, and didn't you say that really this is, from the BC government point of view, they're just making it easy on themselves. If you don't have to arrest people, and if you don't have to put them through the court system, and you don't have to send them to jail, well, you just don't have to do all those things at vast expense, and furthermore, it's unrecorded, so you can say crime is going down.
Well, it's like Holland. It's pretty tough to get arrested in Holland because nothing's illegal.
But it doesn't mean the crimes aren't happening.
It's
just like the insanity in California, where they basically legalized shoplifting. So whole business districts are closing because, lo and behold, people started shoplifting. And I get tired of that. It's the same sort of delusion. Well, it's for the single mom who needs bread and milk for her children. Well, no, that quote unquote single mom is stealing Nikes and televisions, guys. She's not going for the
and in the case of BC, you'd think that, okay, so, you know, obviously the toxicity of the drug supply is one issue, but if this program was really working and it was such a success, then why are people still dying? I mean, all you have to do is to get your drugs is to walk in and get a prescription.
Increasingly so, it's not working. There's no beating around that bush. It's not working.
No. So, well, and even in Oregon, like what they did, and Oregon was really bad. I don't know.
Oregon's
bad. I like Portland. I've been to Portland quite a few times. And when, you know, like the last few years, it was getting pretty scary.
Well, I think they've abandoned that whole approach in Oregon.
It started off as kind of a compassionate thing.
Yeah. I'm hoping that maybe BC's hitting that tipping point where at least the reality is going to soak in and they'll start backing off.
Well, they're going to have to start putting something into treatment.
Yeah.
You know, I got a feeling that there's a lot of tipping points that are starting to tip.
They're starting to, I think. You know, the wave is finally hitting the crest, and people are saying, wow, this is, you know, where there's trans issues and other things, people are just saying, enough is enough.
Extremism is. Yeah.
There's hope.
Yes. And we're get on to, there is. Well, there is. Yeah. So we got to maintain that. We complain. So we'll get on to drunks. Since we're on the drugs, we'll finish up with vodka. Hey, alcoholism, serious. I'm aware of that, and I'm open about that as well. I've had my battles with that, and you know, I'm good and sober and enjoying it now. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get sober because the government intervened and made sure I couldn't buy big bottles of vodka. I got sober because my wife would have killed me if I didn't, and a number of other issues. But this is ridiculous, I think, in my view.
It's not free market economics. I mean, of all the governments and again, I hope that there's a little chat in the Premier's office. You know, if these people are paying the taxes that they are supposed to pay, and I'm sure they are, it's up to them what they sell their drug for.
Yeah, and just background for folks. In Alberta, we had a situation where there were these big water jug-looking bottles for like $45 or something like that of vodka.
Four liters
of vodka. I'm sure it's terrible, terrible vodka, but it's budget-priced, and so be it. And the minister in Alberta got up and started initially talking about regulating liquor prices and the volumes that it could be sold at. And it sounds like they backed off on that pretty quickly, but where did you think you were coming from even talking about that?
Well, you know, governments in Alberta have, you know, traditionally tended to be kind of, Puritan, let's just say, Puritan, you know, social credit. There was a time in this province you couldn't get a drink on Sunday.
I moved to Calgary at that time. You could, but you had to work really hard to find it.
You know, you had a buddy that was selling it out of the garage. Hanging out at the Cecil. Yeah, it was almost as bad.
I don't mind them being Puritan, Sean. I just want them to be conservative. And conservative does not say you're selling your product too cheap.
Well, I mean, what's to stop somebody? I mean, you can buy Texas Mickey's already. Yeah. Like, what stops somebody from buying a case instead of just one big jug?
Well, and that's it. So it was kind of a poorly thought reactionary thing.
The distillery said, too, on their website that it was meant more for wholesaling to restaurants and bars, you know, just because it was more convenient for them for their well liquor instead of having to buy multiple bottles, right?
They said that, didn't they?
And they also said it's the party jug. They marketed it as.
I ran a pub for 5 years, and if I could have bought those jugs, I probably would have, because I don't care what people say and what they claim, and I know I'll probably get emails about it. You can't tell the difference between Grey Goose and that cheap crap in a Caesar. I will give you 100
not
taste
after the third
tests.
Or fourth one. Anyway.
No, not after the, yeah.
But if you want to pay that premium, I'll happily sell it to you. But otherwise, you should just stick to the well liquor, guys.
What are the days when we met here, we always have a little glass of water here?
Oh, well, either way, it was a little distracting spat, and I'm sure there's been a chat and saying, yes, I'm craving a drink. I'll be all right.
Yeah, those days are gone.
Well, the UCP's got bigger fish to fry. But
you'd hope so. It just seemed ironic that the minister of red tape wanted to print more red tape, you know.
Yeah, we don't need more. Okay. Well, that kind of covers what we've got today, guys. I think we've solved a few of the world's problems.
Well, we need to sell a few more copies of the Western Standard.
Well, yes, that's that final thing. I missed that last week. Darn it. I'll finish this with that reminder. So thank you, Nigel. Thank you, Sean. And don't take off, you guys. That's that reminder. The reason we're independent media, the reason we can give you the truth and talk about these things is because you guys have subscribed. $9.99 a month, $100 a year. WesternStandard.news/subscription, please. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do. It's just like buying a newspaper subscription in the past. And if you've already subscribed, thank you very much. We do very much appreciate it. It keeps us rolling and keeps that truth coming your way. So thank you all for tuning in this week. Be sure to tune into our other shows throughout the week and keep going to the Western Standard for your news. And we'll see you again next week with a whole bunch of new issues to chew up for you all over again. Thanks.
Canadian Shooting Sports Association. Without the CSSA, our gun rights would have been taken long, long ago. These guys are on the front lines helping to draft smart and intelligent firearms regulations and legislation in Canada, and more importantly, educating the public about how we keep guns out of the hands of the wrong people. To become a member, it's absolutely worth every penny. You can become a Western Standard member for just $10 a month. Or $99 a year for unlimited access.